These are the stories that you need to know about today. For the first time, half of the people who live in the West say their democracies don't work. A Chinese business person who studied in the United States explains why China is, at least according to him, more democratic than the West. You've got to hear what he has to say. And more European leaders are bailing on Ukraine, evidently. Their reason? Well, the corruption scandal. Even Poland, which is very anti-Russia, usually pro-Ukraine, they seem to be joining this party. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to begin today with a poll that confirms much of what people in the world outside of Western countries kind of already know. But it's particularly newsworthy and certainly noteworthy to hear people who live in the West admit to this because, well, apparently, it's almost like they're starting to feel this intuitively, right? They're not told this by the media. Here's the headline. Almost 50% of all the people who live in Western countries believe that democracy is broken. Broken. The key word there is democracy, though. You know why? Here's why. Because that's the word that's used in the international lexicon to describe the West, right? Democracies. That's how they think they differentiate themselves from the rest. And it's personal for me. See, throughout my entire life, I've heard this as a Westerner. And it goes something like this. We in the West, we're democracy. Whereas those other countries, you know, the people who live in Russia and China and India and the people who live in Latin American nations, you know, Africa, Middle East, those aren't. It's almost like they're kind of inferior. We are freedom-loving in America, right? And who knows what those other people are? I don't know. Savages, I guess. Just like in the old West, you know, the cowboy days, right? Look, I know it sounds crazy. If you're listening to me and you're in a non-Western country and you're hearing this, it kind of sounds crazy that they think that way, but it's true. I mean, let's call it what it is. This is colonial thinking. And it's been around for centuries now. And by the way, the elitists in the government and the corporate reporters that they kind of control, they still insist on pushing the same old narrative that they're a democracy and everybody else isn't. And that is why this headline that I showed you a little while ago, this headline that I showed you, that's why it's so important. Because what it means is, it means the truth may be sinking in for a lot of people who live in the West. The fact that maybe they're not as democratic, translation, superior, as they always kind of thought they were, or we thought we were. I'm one of them. It means citizens in the West are starting to realize what people in the global South communities have known for years. And it's this. Western-style democracies are no longer so democratic. They're not. It's kind of like the illusion of democracy. It's like those of us in the West have always thought of ourselves, for example, that we were choosing our own elected officials, but we aren't anymore. We're not. We think we have free speech in the West, but we kind of don't anymore. We think our governments are for the people, for the average Joe, the little guy. It's not. More and more, those governments are there to serve only the rich and powerful. So let's get to the poll. Look at this. Look at this remarkably affirming Ipsos poll. In France, only 19% of the people who live in France asked say that they're satisfied with their democracy. Only 19%. The United States, only 20%. The UK, Italy, only 26%. Look at Spain, only 27%. Look at Croatia. This is a country that was taken over by NATO and by the EU so that they can learn how to be democracies, right? You could argue they were made that way by force, but that's another day, another newscast. Only 18% there are now satisfied with their newly found Western-style democracy that NATO and the EU have brought to them. 18%? That doesn't sound to me like this thing's working so well. So now let's look at what I like to call the "are you losing sleep" question in this poll. This is fascinating. This is where people were asked if they're worried about what's going to happen in their countries over the next 4 or 5 years, right? So look at this one. 86% of the French are definitely losing some sleep. 86% are worried about the state of their country and their democracy. And it's not just the French. Look at the Spanish, 80%. Look at the Poles, 75%. The UK, 75% of the people there are worried about their democracy. The Netherlands, 74%. Again, Croatia, 73%. The United States, 69%. Italy, 64%. And now, you know what I want to do? A comparison, because I looked this up. What about the people in places like Russia or China? It's the opposite. In Russia, 75% of the people, according to Statista, which is a German pollster, by the way, not a Russian pollster, they found that 75% of the people in Russia are satisfied with their government. They're not worried about it. It's the opposite. A study done by Harvard, the Kennedy School in Harvard, same thing. They studied the Chinese for almost a decade. They found that Chinese citizens rate their government as more capable and effective than at any time in their history. So think about that. It means that according to Western polling agencies and Western research institutes, people in the countries we in the West supposedly considered inferior are happier with their governments than we are in the West. Watch this interview with Eric Lee, who was educated in the United States and used to believe in Western democracies, but now he has a very different opinion. This is interesting. He did this a while ago, but it still holds true. He's in Oxford, no less, when he's doing this, schooling students and faculty there at, you know, Oxford, right? On why, contrary to what they've always believed, he says it's actually the Chinese government that offers more of a representative democracy than Western governments do.
In the Central Committee, in today's Central Committee, the percentage of people who come from a background of any privilege is even smaller. Compare that to the US Senate, for instance. How many are sons of senators and sons of come from wealth? If you go to any Chinese university, I was studying for my PhD at Fudan, and the party recruits at the very grassroots level, the best and the brightest students who come from the countryside, they join the party and they move their way up slowly, step by step. And it's the selection process is very meritocratic and it's very tough, even for Xi Jinping, the new general secretary. He's a princeling, happens to be princeling, but you know, it's amazing. The party has been in power for 64 years. He is the first head of state, head of the party, who comes from a background of political leadership. No one else has. But even for him, the career path took 30 years. He worked his way up from village chief, county chief, mayor, vice mayor, provincial. By the time he made it to the top, he had managed 150 million people and a couple of $1 trillion in combined GDP. The track record is amazing. And you don't make it to the top unless you go through the grinding machine of the party system.
The grinding machine. Let's go to Ukraine now, where the situation seems to be getting dire for the Zelensky government, as apparently more European leaders are continuing to kind of, you know, push back, distance themselves a little bit from the Zelensky government. The latest is the Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, who signaled over the weekend that support for Ukraine is rapidly weakening. Tusk was asked about the $100 million corruption scandal in Ukraine. Seems like everybody's being asked that question. He said that what it's doing is it's making it increasingly difficult to rally public and political backing for Ukraine these days.
Now, that pro-Ukrainian enthusiasm, as you well know, is much lower both in Poland and globally. People are tired of the war and those expenses. It's not so easy to maintain support for Ukraine in its war against Russia.
By the way, he's not the only one, obviously. We talked about some of these last week, but other European leaders who appear concerned about the corruption are Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz. He spoke up. He's calling for Ukraine to implement anti-corruption measures. Seems a little late, no? The EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, she said that the corruption scandal in Ukraine is definitely unfortunate, in her words. By the way, credit where credit is due, right? The one Western leader who has consistently been the most skeptical about Zelensky on this matter has been President Trump. You got to give him the credit, right? He is the one who called Zelensky the greatest salesman on earth. And in August, remember, he said Zelensky had fleeced Americans out of $350 billion during the Biden administration. But here's the most recent commentary on Ukraine. It occurred this weekend, and it came from Slovakia's Prime Minister, Robert Fico. Have you seen this? So Fico's speaking to an audience, and mostly students, that he tells them that he definitely will not vote to send more EU money to Ukraine, and certainly not the $140 billion package that they're proposing in Brussels.
The EU wants to make a decision that in 2026 and 2027, we would give Ukraine 140 billion euros for military expenses. Excuse me, you can agree with that, and I will respect your opinion, but I'm telling you that I will never agree with this opinion. Never. I refuse for Slovakia to participate in any financial or other scheme that gives Ukraine $140 billion for the next 2 years for the war. It is very sorrowful for me because it is a road to hell. I don't want wars. I want it to end.
He wants it to end and doesn't think giving it money will help it end. In fact, he seems to be saying, give it more money, it'll continue. Then something interesting happened. Fico, I could tell because I've watched this a couple of times, he noticed that there were some pro-Ukrainian protesters there in the audience who disagreed with them. Usually when you're speaking, you can tell when people are looking at you with a sour face, right? In fact, he knew that they were getting ready to do something, to get up and make a demonstration of some form, right? And when they tried to confront him, he told them, look, I respect your point of view. But then he suggested to them, maybe they should just go back if they're that concerned and fight for their country instead of being there with a sign. Here, watch it for yourself.
Once again, young man, go, stand up, fight in Ukraine. Feel free to. Well, when there is a different opinion, it is disrespected. I absolutely, fundamentally reject that. The students left after I said that if you want to go fight, then go. Take a rifle and go there to fight against the Russians.
It seems kind of fascinating that this is happening right now, that there seems to be a lot of anti-Ukraine sentiment suddenly bubbling up in European countries. And obviously, somebody like Fico's said things like this before, but to hear it from perhaps the Germans and the Brussels, that starts to make things a little different. How much is it eroding? We're going to talk about that. Because as Vladimir Zelensky continues to face this eroding support from the EU and the fallout from the corruption scandal that's engulfed Kyiv, there's another situation that's just as serious. In fact, I would argue it's even more serious. And that is the Ukrainian army is getting its butt kicked. It really is. Not according to me, but according to people who know about these kinds of things. Military experts, people who study this stuff on the ground. And we happen to have one of them who's going to be sitting right here, and he's going to be taking us through this in just a little bit. His name is U.S. Army officer, retired, Stanislav Krapivnik. He's going to be right here. He's good. Handsome guy, too. I told him a little while ago. He's going to join us in just a little bit. Okay, here we go. We got a military guy. You know what I mean? He's a military guy. He understands military strategy, and that's really important to understand. I think people in the future are going to look at this Ukraine war and learn a lot from it. It's almost the development of the new way of fighting wars. Very few people are as good as my guest to talk about this. Stanislav Kaprovnik is a former U.S. Army officer in the Carolinas, right?
Well, served at Fort Bragg. I lived...
Most people would argue there's no place better.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I mean, if you want to be...
the base isn't bad, but Fayetteville and those places,
I don't mean like that. I mean, from a military standpoint, that's where you get the best training.
Yeah. Fort Bragg's a good place.
So here we are now looking at what's going on in Ukraine, and a lot of people are trying to figure it out. It seems like the consensus is that Ukraine is getting its butt kicked.
It is.
It is, right? Yeah. No matter how much... Even if we wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt, it's...
It is. Yeah. It all started with the fast Russian maneuvers that came in there because the point wasn't to conquer Ukraine. That's why you had 30,000 troops outside of Kyiv, city of 2.5 million. Yeah. You couldn't take it. It was there to keep the Ukrainians under pressure so they wouldn't move anywhere because the job was to get them to the negotiation tables, get them to be neutral. Boris Johnson, we all know the story, what happened with there.
He said, no, we got to keep fighting. Keep fighting. You're going to beat these guys. You could beat the Russians.
We'll give you everything. We'll beat the Russians. Well, then Russia changed tactics because it still somewhat continued to fight. But then it came, became apparent that, this is going to get settled on the battlefield. It's not going to get settled in negotiations because the other side doesn't want negotiations. And that's when it started changing.
So, wait, I'm almost hearing you say that, and pardon me for interrupting, I'm kind of framing this, I think, for our viewers, or trying to. Most of them are smarter than I am. But the Russians went into this as a boo tactic, as in, we're going to scare the hell out of them, they're going to come to the negotiating table, and then we'll give them a little bit about what they want, and then we'll be able to keep some of what we want, and that didn't work.
Well, the job when the first happened was, Donetsk People's Republic, Lugansk People's Republic, they were going to get independence.
Right. Let's put those up, by the way. This is map number 4, where we see the 4 oblasts. Can we put those up, Gene, so people know what we're talking about as we talk about it? This is map number 4. Mm-hmm. There it is.
Yeah, they were going to get independence originally under a Russian plan because they had been suffering attacks by Ukraine.
We're seeing Lugansk at the top there, right?
Right.
You see it?
Lugansk, and the next one is Donetsk.
Right.
They had been under fire by Ukraine since 2014. Mm-hmm. Lugansk is my home city. I've got relatives up and down there that have lived for 12 years under fire from Ukraine. But as far as Zaporozhye, as far as Kherson, that wasn't going to be part of the plan because the plan was to push Ukraine into signing a status of neutrality. Mm-hmm. So no NATO, no NATO missiles on the Russian border, the way Blinken said to Lavrov, we'll do whatever we want. The question is just how many missiles we put
Lugansk on. And Lugansk and Donetsk, we just saw the top two oblasts would become under Russian protectorate.
Russian protectorate, but individual governments.
Okay.
That was the original plan. When that became obvious, that's not going to happen.
Because Boris Johnson said we don't want that to happen.
Well, because Blinken told Boris Johnson to go down there and sabotage it.
Right.
After that, when it became apparent this is going to be a long-term conflict...
Russia changed its tactic.
It did, but there was more than just that. It was drones. You see, the Russian government, the Russian military, just like the American, the Germans, everybody else... Post-World War II, everybody was trained on these big maneuver moves. You get brigades of armor coming in, you get battalions of armor. Things change with the drones. Drones severely change it. Tanks are still there. They're just used absolutely differently than they used to be. You don't have the big moves of battalion-sized elements or brigade-sized elements. So Russia changed over to a war of attrition, where Russia dominates in
tactical warfare.
Well, it's not just tactical. Russia dominates in aviation. Russia dominates in tube artillery. Russia dominates in rocket artillery. Now Russia dominates in first-person view drones, FPV drones. Mm-hmm. It didn't for the first 2 years, but it has caught up. And Russia dominates in the big drones. So at this point, number one... Russia moves it's starting to move faster now, obviously. But Russia's moving more like a vacuum. It comes up to an enemy position, just destroys it, sucks everything up that's there, moves forward. So it was slow, incremental moves. But as Ukraine starts to get attrited, as its better units are being destroyed, its veterans are gone. And Kursk, by the way, was a death knell for most of these, because Ukraine took what is called fire brigades. So you get a brigade. A fire brigade is a brigade that's used to plug up holes wherever the enemy punches through your line.
Right.
They separate out maybe a company, maybe a battalion. They rush in there. They counterattack. They solidify the front. And then they hold it till regular units come in there and then establish the new line.
Interesting.
And they run up and down the front this way. Well, they're the elite units because you have to be mobile. You have to be high quality to be able to stop a breakthrough. Well, all these units got sucked up into Kursk, where they got destroyed.
When the Zelensky government decided to invade Russia through Kursk.
Well, let's be honest. When the American and British generals planned a mission in Kursk out of NATO and the Ukrainian generals executed as they were supposed to. And
really?
The New York Times, by the way, confirmed what I've been saying 2 years before that.
So the invasion of Russia through Kursk was basically the United States, MI6, the CIA...
Yeah, whoever's running around there.
Really.
Yeah,
wow.
Just Krinky was a British operation where they put two Marine battalions, sunk two Marine battalions on a small stretch of beach with a small village, three rows of houses under heavy Russian artillery. They just kept pumping people in there to die.
I always thought that was Zelensky's harebrained idea because, you know, he's like a performer and he likes big acts. You know, we're going to make a big show. Watch. We're going to get the world's attention. That's what I thought it was. You're here to say, no, it had nothing to do with Zelensky.
Well, there is that element that they need PR, right?
Right.
The counteroffensive of 23, that PR. You know, I don't think any time in history has anybody advertised for half a year, I'm going to attack you right here. I'm going to put my right foot upside your left ear right now. Nobody does that. You want an element of surprise. We may attack here. No. We're definitely going to attack here.
But
don't get ready because we're going to come right here.
It was promoted like a Super Bowl.
It was.
Yeah.
It was a boxing match.
Coming
we're
soon.
Coming. And it turned into a massacre.
Yeah.
Just to understand, Ukraine took 120 square kilometers, which sounds big for people who don't think about it. It's 12 kilometers by 6 kilometers, or 8 miles by 6 miles. They lost 80,000 dead.
Wow.
That's World War I tactics. That's just body waves. You know, massive grave heaps of corpses. That's what they did.
So you're saying the two stupid things that the Ukrainians have done...
Well, not the only two.
...that didn't help... Well, the two most stupid things that they did that have really hurt their cause militarily was Kursk and that surge or the offensive...
Right. Zaporozhye, that was the two big ones. But, you know, Ukraine since 2014 has this tradition of getting themselves surrounded. They'll either burst through the lines of the rebels and get surrounded in a cauldron, or they wait in place so long that they get surrounded. This is what we see in Pokrovsk.
Speaking of surrounded, can you give me the map of Pokrovsk? This is map number two, Gene. Can you put that one up so we can talk about it? Okay, this is that famous flank maneuver where you see Pokrovsk kind of in the middle there. Well, it's red now, but for many months we've been seeing it non-red. And you could see, you see how it's surrounded, you see how it's flanked, right? It's like a pincer almost above north of Pokrovsk. See where those red lines are now coming together? That means that whole green area there that looks like a lake, that's where there still could be some Ukrainian soldiers, correct?
Oh, there's probably about 3,000 to 5,000 still in there.
What's going to happen to those people?
They'll either surrender or die. If you notice, there is a corridor open, and there's a reason you do that. The reason you don't fully surround the enemy is to give him an out, psychological out. So there's a corridor, it's under threat, and your average guy who's pinned down, he hasn't eaten in a week, he's running out of ammunition, which is, by the way, the Ukrainians, is going, I might be able to make it. Sooner or later, and it's happening right now, is they try to make it out. Most of them will be killed or captured trying to get out. Some will get out. But that breaks morale. If you fully surround them, they've got one of two choices, stand and fight. And like it or not, Ukrainians are Russians, whether or not they want to admit it. And so they're just as stubborn as we are. Or surrender. So it's better to give them an out so sooner or later morale breaks and they try to make a run for it. That's why you don't fully close. But
put that map again, Gene. Put that map up again so he can refer to it.
Mm-hmm.
Same map, the Pokrovsk map. There it is.
Yeah, if you... What happens when you get the big surround? Now, Pokrovsk is fully in Russian hands.
Right.
The Ukrainians are doing counter assaults right now. They pulled together some kind of reserves because their strategic reserves are gone. They pulled together about 10,000 troops. They're trying to break through. These from the reports coming from the front, these are absolutely green people.
And they're trying to break through. The Ukrainians are trying to get away where those two intersecting arrows are.
Well, no, right there. Those are the ones trapped inside. But from the outside, they're trying to break in.
I see.
And open up. But the troops that they're using, they're trying to assault into Pokrovsk. The troops that they're using are people that just freshly press ganged off the street.
So the ones coming in are coming in from Grishino and from Rodinskoye right there, coming down. Right.
Trying to break through to open up a corridor.
Are they going to be able to?
No. And from the looks of it, I mean, it's just meat waves, basically. People absolutely with no training. 1 week from being on the street to being on the front, and then a day later, you're dead. I mean, that's the cycle for these guys. Unfortunately, but that's exactly how it runs.
That
now, the people
terrible.
That are inside Pokrovsk, that big circle, what's happening right now is you do an encirclement, and then you start breaking up into manageable, chewable parts. Because you don't want to squeeze all it because it takes too much resources. So what right now we have is on the southern portion, Russian forces are liberating the southern part of Mirograd, which is mostly one, two-story private houses. And from the other side, the Russian forces have already left Pokrovsk and are heading in. So they're going to chop off that little bottom third.
Right.
And then that's going to get liquidated. And then you move the troops up and you start chunking up another piece. So you take any kind of these encirclements,
so
you take them a bunch of.
So when we reported that the Russians have already really taken Pokrovsk.
They have.
And now it's a mop-up operation.
Right.
That you're describing that mop-up operation as really just controlling the whole area around there.
Right.
And then being able to move through.
Right. So there's still a substantial Ukrainian presence there. But like I said, intercepts are coming in. These guys are complaining that their headquarters, look, one guy was saying, I ate a pack of cookies. That was the only food I had for an entire week.
Yeah.
It's cold. It's miserable. Calorie burn is high. Ammunition's running low. Food is gone.
So they're going to surrender.
Either surrender or they're going to die.
Or they're going to die.
That's the only option they really have. They can try to make a run for it. Most of them will die trying to make a run for it. They're better off surrendering. They're much better off surrendering. They get to live and they get to go home. A lot of them, by the way, also put in for Russian citizenship while they're in the camps.
Yeah, because they start talking to the Russian soldiers. Yeah. They're basically like cousins.
Oh, brothers of the same family.
It's a weird war, unlike what's happening like in Gaza,
war.
Where mm-hmm. two of the people who hate each other more than any people in the history of the world are facing off. This is a war where you have basically family members fighting with each other.
Which Gaza is interesting, too, because, by the way, they both trace the Palestinians and the Jews both trace themselves back to Abraham.
Right.
So, in a way, they're also relatives.
They're also but
more distant.
A little
obviously.
Bit more distant. All right, let's talk about another place now. And this is one that you have been talking about in particular. It's a place called, pardon my pronunciation, because I pronounce O's as O's and Russians pronounce O's as A's for some reason, Orefkov. Which you would say Arefkov, right?
Areshnik.
Areshnik.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Not Areshnik.
There it is on the map.
Arefkov. Yeah. It's in.
Orekhov. Yeah. There you go.
It's in Arekhov.
Yes.
It's
Arekhov.
In,
thank you.
Zaporozhye. What's more important though than Arekhov? Because there's movements toward liberating Zaporozhye city.
Right.
So you've got three major cities you have to take. You have Zaporozhye City, you have Orekhov, and you have Gulyaypolye.
Got it. I see it right
the
there.
East.
There it is. There it is. Yeah. So it looks like they've already taken Orekhov, right? Because you see that little red line? That's the Russian military that's just reached the area there, right?
Yeah, it's in the process.
But
when it falls, what's more important than Orekhov, though, is Gulyaypolye.
Why?
For several reasons. Because Gulyaypolye is probably the biggest fortress right now on the east of Zaporozhye. You can't take it from the south because it's on high ground. And coming in, you're in the open, heading toward high ground, and it's just a massacre. There's been several probing attacks, company level and such, before over the last couple of years, and it's just too well defended. So there's a big circle coming around. And the defenses on the east of Gulyaypolye have collapsed. And the Russian army is coming up toward Gulyaypolye from the east and from the north. So it's about 60% surrounded. There's still supply coming in, but it's getting very, very chancy. The supply that they used to have coming in directly, supply line from Krasnoarmeysk, which is now fully, we just discussed.
Right, which is next to Pokrovsk.
Right. Well, it is Pokrovsk. It's the old name for Pokrovsk.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's been cut for a long time, but that used to be the main supply area, Dnipropetrovsk, Pokrovsk, or Krasnoarmeysk, and then down to Gulyaypole. That's gone. So there they only have through Orekhov. The problem is, and there's another moment. Can you put up...
Which map do you want?
The full map.
The full map of all the... Right.
Okay, so that little dip down is Gulyaypole. Right. And then all the way up, including Pokrovsk, is a 100-kilometer front. Mm-hmm. That's the area where the main Ukrainian defenses they've been building up since 2014 are gone. Mm. Pokrovsk, that area, Pokrovsk, Mirograd, they're the last fortress cities. From there to Dnieper, there's very little to stop fast movement.
That's where it gets really interesting, because I was going to ask you about one other place before we move on to what happens after this is gone. So we showed you what happens south of Pokrovsk. Mm-hmm. We showed you Pokrovsk. Now let's go north of Pokrovsk to a place called Kupiansk. Let me see that map of Kupiansk. There's Kupiansk. Mm-hmm. See it right there?
Right.
What's the significance of Kupiansk? Because that's far away from Pokrovsk. Well, and yet there's a big movement and a lot of battles being fought there right now.
That's going in. So we're already going into Kharkiv Oblast. So for liberation of Kharkiv, which is it has to be liberated, mm-hmm. because Kharkiv is about 40 kilometers away from Belgrade.
And you say Kharkiv, most people say Kharkiv.
I know. It's
sorry.
K-h-h-ha.
Okay.
Kharkiv.
It's an American thing.
I know.
Apologize.
It's not only all the Europeans say the same
yeah,
way.
Yeah, they say Kharkiv. Okay. So that's that Kharkiv Oblast.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kharkiv Oblast has to be liberated if just to be a buffer, because from Kharkiv, they're directly shelling into Belgrade, which is 40 kilometers. So any medium range, short range, the short enough range missiles, heavy enough artillery, it'll reach from city center. Huh. So to make that buffer to defend that area, you got to take Kharkiv.
So Russians are defending their border mm-hmm. by being far enough away to create a buffer. So
right.
in the future, there is a truce and that land goes back to the Ukrainians.
Well, that's a good question, though, because that land is Russian. And those are Russians living there.
Yeah, that gets us back to the beginning.
Yeah, my father was born there. That's Russian land. So again, that's up to the people to decide where they want to be at the end of this. But as long as Ukraine is fighting, that border is going to be moving, whether they like it or not. They don't like it, obviously.
Yeah.
But Kupiansk frees up a lot of operational force to further go and encircle down into the big last agglomeration of Slavinsk, Kramatorsk, and Konstantinovka.
Right.
First you have to take Krasny Liman, but these are all still somewhat connected areas.
But it all looks like eventually. Well, let me not. Mm-hmm. It would be journalistically unsound for me to lead you with this question. So let me ask the question. Mm-hmm. Does it appear to you like that description of that entire line, all the way from Kupiansk, all the way down through Pokrovsk and into Zaporizhia, does it look to you like it's inevitable that eventually that's going to be in Russian hands?
Absolutely. Yeah. And also there's now combat going on the edges of Kherson, on the other side of the Dnieper River.
Right.
So what you're seeing right now, first of all, the whole front's alive, including up in Sumy, including up in Volchansk, which has now fallen totally into Russian hands, which is why the Ukrainians blew up the dams on the Serebryanka in Belgrade
and
to flood that area.
And let me just, for perspective, give people a... Put up that frontline map one more time. I want to say something that I learned from my friend Larry Johnson. If you look at that, all the way up from above Kupiansk, all the way down to Gulyaypole, or actually going through the Zaporizhia region, think of it this way if you're watching us from the United States. That's like from Boston to Miami.
Yep.
It is a lot of land.
We're
not talking about a little place here.
And it's all moving.
Yeah.
So there's two things.
At one time.
That's right.
Imagine a front in the United States from Boston to Miami moving forward with a military.
There's about 9 axes of advance right now, major axes of advance. What this tells you two things. One, the Russian army has now built up enough force and experience, because what the Russian army does is it rotates battalions and brigades in to the front line. They get 6 months or so experience, they rotate out, the next one goes in. So they're building up experience. Right. The Ukrainians don't rotate. They bring in and they stay there till they die, or they run away, or they get injured and evacuated out.
God bless them.
It's a one-way ticket for most of them.
You feel bad for them?
You know, because they are Russians, and I do have relatives on that side, I do feel bad for them.
But, it's bad leadership.
Many are, it's bad. Well, I don't want them to win, obviously, so yeah, I'm glad they have bad leadership.
No, I understand.
I've got a big dog in this fight, considering how many of my relatives are under fire. On the other hand, for Russians, this is a civil war. They're fighting ourselves. So this is, and for most Russians, they view this as a civil war. The Ukrainians might not view it that way, but a lot of them do, actually. They're starting to understand. There were even clips, you know, there was a interesting clip that came out. There was a group of Ukrainians surrounding a forest. The Russian soldiers screaming for them to surrender. And they come back with, "We're Russians. We don't surrender." But you're fighting your own. That's a point. Yeah.
You know what this reminds me of? What you just said? I don't know how much you know. Yeah, well, you're a military guy, and you guys study as much history as anybody. During the Civil War in the United States, the South was backed by the UK, the British, who wanted cheap cotton, so they were all for black slaves, but not in their country. So they wanted the South to win the war so they continued to get that cheap cotton, as well as other Europeans like the French. So they were funding the war, the Civil War in the United States, and using the South as proxies. You could argue the same thing is taking place right now.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
But the Europeans are just, instead of the South, they're using the Ukrainians as a proxy.
Oh, yeah, they absolutely use a proxy. They're used by proxy by the Germans in World War II. They're used by the proxy as a proxy by the Germans in World War I. From the western edges, Pichlura and his 40,000 were set up by the Kaiser. Unfortunately, this is nothing new.
Yeah.
Very unfortunate. But the politics of that area, to understand the politicians in Ukraine, it's an art form of knowing when to betray whomever you're loyal to. Mm. Because Ukraine is, with a direct translation of that word, is hinterland. You don't find hinterlandian countries, because hinterland means the edge of something else, something bigger. So they're between the edge of Rzecz Pospolita, which is the Polish Empire, and the Russian Empire. So that was that zone. And they all learned, how to switch sides effectively, and B, how to betray your buddy for a better price.
Yeah.
And that was the politics of Ukraine, and that, unfortunately, is still the politics.
And now they're playing for bigger stakes.
And steal as much as you can.
Yeah, now they're playing for hundreds of billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's like, who's going to pay me more, and sure, I'll wear your uniform kind of thing.
Zelensky bought an investment bank in London for $1.5 billion pounds. He supposedly is now the ninth largest private landowner in the U.S.,
That's crazy. But
there was a report. Now they're denying it, but you know, it's kind of.
And we need to be careful with some of this stuff, because there's a lot of reports out there. And to just, you know, we want to remain as journalistically sound as possible as we go through this. But here's the Mac Daddy money question that everybody wants to know. And since you're a military guy, I know you don't know the answer to this, but at least you can give me an educated opinion. If the Russians break through, as you said they eventually will, what happens after that? Can they just run roughshod all the way to Kiev? Do you think they can go all the way to Odessa? Let me ask the question this way. What can stop them after you're done with Kupiansk and Prokhorovsk and Oreshkov and all those other places?
Stop or slow down?
Okay,
very
you choose.
Different. If we're talking, first, nature will slow down because the Dnieper River is a barrier. It's a crossable barrier. We've crossed it more than once before. So, and the Germans crossed it when they needed to, when they were attacking. So it's a crossable barrier. But it is a barrier. Luckily, the Ukrainian army isn't that strong to try to really defend it. They will, but it will be crossed.
And that's the river that's right on the other side of those four oblasts.
It's the Mississippi of Ukraine. You know, it's the lifeblood of the industrial belt in Ukraine.
Is there a possibility the Russians could end up with everything that's east of the river, and the Ukrainians could end up everything west of that river?
They could, but if we're going to talk actual Russian territories, Odessa, Nikolaev, Poltava, Dnipropetrovsk, Kiev, Sumy, Kharkov, those are all Russian areas.
That's where native Russians
absolutely
live.
Russian. You know that when the Bolsheviks started Russification, Ukrainization in the 1920s, the people in Kiev were very surprised to learn that they were Ukrainians. And they were forced to learn the Ukrainian language if they wanted to be in any kind of positions of authority.
So people in those places you just mentioned speak Russian?
Yes.
Or not all of them, but in some places 70%, in some places 45%.
In some places 90%+.
Yeah.
In fact, Ukrainization, for those that may question what I just said, all you got to do is go into Google or go into Yandex, write Ukrainization 1920s, look at images, and you get scanned headlines. Of course, they're in Russian, but you get scanned headlines of newspapers from the Soviet Union proclaiming success here in Ukrainization, success there in Ukrainization, all through the 20s after the Russian Civil War. So those people, those areas are ethnic Russian areas. The further west you go, originally, those were all Russian areas, too. In fact, Galicia was one of the oldest Russian kingdoms or provinces going back well over 1,000 years. But they got Polonized, and they got the Hungarians came in there. So those areas remixed a lot. But the areas just both sides of the Dnieper, those are Russian areas.
Let's try, because we only have about 5 minutes left, so let's try and figure out maybe some of the politics of this now. Given the situation that you saw me describe a little while ago about where the Europeans are starting to finally look at Zelensky and says, we can't back you anymore because you're so dirty. It's just hard for us to back you. If he loses the European backing, if he's not going to get any more funding, which it looks like he's not for a while, how long can they last? Some people say this can't go past spring of next year, probably sooner. Well, you say what?
There's a good American saying, it's all over but the dying. And that's been the truth for quite a while, unfortunately. And then the dying can go on for quite a while. Let's not forget Vietnam Nguyen Diem was assassinated partially by the U.S.
Yeah.
And then just replaced it with another guy, and they kept the Vietnam War kept rolling for another decade after that. So will they say we've given up? I doubt it. They've, particularly the Western Europeans. The only way this ends for the Western Europeans is when they go away. I'm talking about the politicians, because they've invested everything in it. And try after you've ruined the German economy or you've ruined the French economy. There are hundreds of dead Frenchmen for some reason or other up and down that whole battlefield, and there are. And then you turn around to go to the French people as Macron and go, well, you know,
we're out.
That was a mistake. Let's have a beer. You know, no, it doesn't work that way. You know, the British have been changing the prime ministers left and right. So Starmer's got it a little bit easier out on that.
So they're like too big to fail.
They're too big to fail. They've invested too much. They're invested mentally, psychologically. They're invested emotionally. They're invested financially. Because they were all told, you know, Russia will be dead in 2 months or two weeks.
But Trump is out. Trump is out already. He is. I mean, he's saying, if you guys want to keep fighting and send me money for our weapons, great. I think he's out in terms of intellectually out.
Yeah. I would argue that was at least Trump's, if not even Biden's overall plan. Get this going far enough and then make money off the weapons. Because the Europeans don't have enough. The Germans are ramping up production. They are. But they're still a long way off from even rebuilding their own army. And by the way, now that the Germans have declared they're going to be the preeminent military power in Europe, all of a sudden the French and the Poles are not exactly too thrilled with that. Like, they remember their history.
Yeah.
And when somebody like Merz is going to have a huge army under his hands.
So bottom line is, I hear you saying that you're not confident that there's going to be any one thing that could bring this to an end. And this war of attrition can continue for some time. Although my next question is an obvious one. How do you keep, Stas, fighting a war if you don't have soldiers? What are they going to fight with?
Well, it will be a systemic collapse. The only question now is, will NATO, at least in the face of the Western Europeans, come in and join the fracas, or will they stay out? Officially staff. I mean, there's plenty guys getting killed down there as it is.
You mean like Frenchmen and
officially
and
UK under
boots on the ground?
Official boots
on
the ground.
That's World War III, isn't it?
Yeah, well, conventionally wise, yeah. And it could be.
Good God.
At this point.
For what?
Well,
that would be so stupid.
They're already there.
Yeah, well, we know they're
in Odessa,
there, but they're in hiding.
They're in Odessa. There's thousands of Frenchmen in Odessa, the French Foreign Legion, which is part of the French Army. There's SAS and other units of the British Army in Odessa. We know that for a fact. They're all over that area. Whether or not they're further, if they're not officially there, but they're there, and we know that they're there. Whether or not they go officially into that, well, we'll live and see. Desperate people in government, as they say, when all else fails, they take us to war. And that's what we're looking in the West.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And voting isn't going to change anything.
Are U.S. I know there's some U.S. soldiers. There's some U.S. presence there, but not in the same numbers as the French in the U.K., I hope. For my country?
The U.S., well, in Europe, the U.S. is pulling troops out right now, but I think that's because of Venezuela. Because they're pulling out the 82nd Airborne, they're pulling out 101st Airborne out of Poland and Romania. Those are light infantry, high mobility troops. They're being pulled back into the U.S. because there possibly is going to be Vietnam 2.0 in Venezuela, if they're crazy enough
but
to go in
there. Has the U.S. ever had large forces of troop movements or troops in general in Ukraine proper?
Officially, of course, no. Some possible instructors, special forces.
Of course, yeah.
I would say the people in the HIMARS and the Patriots are probably hired. Whether they're out of the military fully or not is questionable, but they're under
You're
one
of these.
You're
out of the military for a week while you run this machine.
You know, they do that. They officially quit, you know, officially, and they're officially in Blackwater, and then they're officially then, back in the military. It happens.
You commission and then recommission.
Yeah, it's a crazy concept.
Seems a little dirty poolish to me, but it is what it is.
It is what it is. And I don't think, you know, HIMARS, I'm guarantee that that's either Americans or Brits behind the wheel.
The weapon.
The platforms, right.
Yeah.
If you look at...
And the Patriot is obviously American.
The Patriot, the full battery, Patriot battery is 94 people. It takes almost a year to train a mechanic. Officers take half a year to train up. How many Ukrainians did they train for that? They're getting destroyed. So if they're bringing in new Patriot systems from the U.S. or from Germany or from Poland, well, they're bringing them in with crews.
Yeah. So really, it's almost like it's over, but now it's the continuation for the sake of continuation.
Yeah.
And we'll see if that breaks along the way. In the meantime, at some point, you would think that someone would sit down and negotiate. But the fact of the matter is, there hasn't really been a serious negotiation, with the exception of the one that Boris Johnson, he's another story.
Yeah,
one that Boris Johnson basically derailed. That was the only real close where real terms were discussed.
Right.
Everything else has been bullcrap.
It wasn't officially signed, but it was notarized already on agreements. You know, the document was ready to go. And this all could have been avoided. 2 million dead Ukrainian soldiers and NATO mercs could have been avoided.
And Russia would have had less than half of what they have now.
Of course.
Isn't that amazing?
And that's been a whole history. You know, nobody will leave us alone, but we're good at beating back whoever invades us, and then following home. The first invasion of Rus by Europeans was in 1012 AD. Boleslav Hrabry, the Prince of Krakow, and his Holy Roman Empire allies, Germans, from different Germanic states, they invaded, they took Kiev, and they pushed further, and then they got pushed out. And after that, it's been 1,000 years of this. So, unfortunately, this isn't anything new. Hitler.
Where is Ivan the IV when we need him the most?
Oh,
that guy was good at getting new territory. I love you, man. You're
same,
the best.
Same.
Thanks so much for coming by and visiting and sharing with us so much of your wisdom. It's fascinating to hear you tell these stories and to get a better feel for what's happening. And, you know, look, we all want this thing to end.
Yeah.
For the sake of Ukraine, for the sake of Russia, and for the sake of the world. Because it just seems kind of foolhardy at this point.
It is. It is.
But it is what it is. There he is. My friend Stas, as I like to call him. I don't think anybody else calls him that way. Former U.S. Army officer. Let me check in on something else now. I want to share with you guys something which is interesting. These are the comments that you guys, so many of you have liked or commented on our program in the last couple of weeks. We get tens of thousands of you who say things, and I swear I try to read every one of them. Let's start with Dajai Ice. She says, Rick and Tucker, you're the best of a dying breed. That's very nice. And I'll pass this on to Tucker so he knows, by the way. Emmett Brooks says the U.S. is the most undemocratic and anti-capitalist nation on Earth. Meanwhile, Special Dino says just the opposite. She likes the other story. She says the secondary sanctions are so much more effective than the sanctions on Russia. The purpose is to get Russia to the negotiating table and end the war. There you go. The Russians would rather suffer economically than to end this war. Rubio got an undesirable answer from Lavrov. No meeting in Budapest means a disappointed Trump. Now, Russia is ranked last on the Global Peace Index measure. Well, thank you for that. Also, Sanskrit 2016, stop laughing, says, you think Zelensky is corrupt? He's an angel. relative to the U.S. operatives, the military-industrial complex, ex-politicians, lobbyists in Washington. Thank you, sir. And then Kathleen Adair wrote this about my interview with Christopher Halali. Great interview. Thank you for all your broadcasts. Encouraging to hear the truth. Thank you, Kathleen. That is so nice. I'll be sending you that $5 bill, I promised. We do love to hear more of your thoughts, so do me a favor. Go, let us know what you think. Tell us either on the YouTube channel, it's called Journalistically Speaking with Rick Sanchez, or you can send comments to my ex, or wait a minute, Journalistically Speaking is on YouTube, ex Twitter is Rick Sanchez TV. Got it correct now. Whichever place you want to go and leave your comments, I'll be reading them, I guarantee it. That's all from us. Thank you for being with us. On behalf of Stas and myself, we say good night and thank you for letting us be in your homes. See you next time. Okay.